Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e. Minen yuji hina.
Ekose.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints on this week's show. Susan Holt was sworn in as New Brunswick's first woman premier.
It's a dream come true to be able to serve the province that I love. It has been the best days of my life.
Words will have consequences, says Cecil Clark, Cape Breton's regional municipality and newly elected mayor. He vows to tackle racism and homophobia in the province.
We cannot allow the hate to exist or persist in our world, and we have to call it out.
The Chocotin National Government and Museum of Vancouver partner up to repatriate long-lost ancestral belongings.
It's just really awakened a lot of questions in them about some of this missing knowledge that's in their community and how they're going to maybe go about bringing it back. It's really a beautiful thing.
We'll go green and talk about microforest planting in the center of Montreal and over to Ontario, where we hear about the butterfly Flyaway project, giving insects, butterflies, and bees a helping hand.
If something is eating my garden, I am super happy. Worldwide, we have lost 40% of our insects.
And also in Ontario, some volunteers gather to save the halibutan gold trout, one egg at a time.
They grow and they go into tanks and then bigger tanks. And 18 months from now, these guys will be stocked into Halliburton lakes. I mean, this is a healthy fish here in this lake.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Nice to have you with us. Happy to be here. My name is Morris Chassin, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Well, New Brunswick's political history was made official last Saturday with the swearing-in last weekend of Susan Holt, the first woman to hold the position of premier. Holt was visibly emotional during the ceremony, especially so when swearing in the five women who will work in her 19-person cabinet. The new premier invited dozens of women in leadership, past and present, from across all parties to be in attendance, saying, "I would not be here if it weren't for them," when addressing reporters. The 61st New Brunswick legislative session is set to begin on November 19. Priorities for the new government include reversing the changes to Policy 713, which forbid teachers from respecting name and pronoun changes of students under the age of 16 without parental consent. Priorities also include repealing Regulation 8420, which excludes abortion from Medicare coverage, as well as imposing a provincial rent cap by February 1st. One of our newest collaborators, Johnny James, based in Fredericton, New Brunswick, has that story for us.
Shortly after 2 p.m. Atlantic time on Saturday, Susan Holt became the first woman to be sworn in as Premier of New Brunswick.
It's a dream come true to be able to serve the province that I love, and people have responded and expressed to us the hope that they're placing in our team, the hope that they're feeling for our province and its future. It has been the best days of my life.
Holt was visibly emotional during the ceremony, especially so when swearing in the five women who will work in her cabinet. The new premier also had multiple women in leadership in attendance from across all parties and gave them a moment of recognition during her acceptance speech.
I would not be here if it weren't for them. The women who came before me paved the way, and every single one of them that got elected made it a little bit easier for the next of us to get here.
Of her 19 cabinet ministers, only two have previous cabinet experience, and 10 are first-time MLAs, which Holt said is intended to bring new voices to the table.
We need to do government and politics differently. We need new perspectives and people who are going to think about things differently and who bring fresh eyes to the work of government, because that's what New Brunswickers told us. They don't want status quo, right? They want a government that's going to be out there, open, transparent about the work, and involving New Brunswickers in the work. And so you'll notice that the cabinet that you have behind you are people who have done a lot of community-based work. They know how to partner with municipalities municipalities and stakeholders and local organizations and do the work on the ground that New Brunswickers are asking for.
When asked about the response to her campaign, which resulted in a 31-seat majority, Holt said that New Brunswickers want to come together.
We are not a divided province. They saw our message of positivity and of hope and a really balanced approach to deliver a fiscally responsible government that's going to improve healthcare services. We were focused on New Brunswickers' priorities. We were out in communities listening to them, and we put forward a team of people who are leaders in their communities, who are working hard to serve their neighbors. I think New Brunswickers responded to that message of coming together and responded to these amazing people.
Holt's cabinet is set to meet for the first time today, with the legislative session set to begin November 19th, with top priorities being undoing the changes to Policy 713 that forbid teachers from respecting name and pronoun changes of students under the age of 16 without parental consent, repealing Regulation 8420 that excludes abortion from Medicare coverage, and instilling a provincial rent cap by February 1st. I'm Johnny James.
To the neighboring province of Nova Scotia now, where Cape Breton's regional municipality mayor, Cecil Clark, told a large audience at the council swearing-in ceremony that racism and homophobia won't be tolerated. Clark says some newcomers are already contacting him, looking for help dealing with racism, and this is because they feel there's nowhere else to turn. Clark says he was victim of homophobic slurs during the recent municipal campaign because of his same-sex marriage. Clark says the council will work with police to decide what the consequences should be for targeting someone's sexual orientation or ethnicity. He says curbing racism and homophobia are among other civic priorities, such as encouraging constituents to be more engaged with the local government, given a drop in voter turnout. Details with Bill McCush in Sydney, Nova Scotia.
Mayor Cecil Clark and the CBRM's 12 councillors were ushered into the swearing-in ceremony to the familiar Cape Breton sounds of drums and bagpipes. About 200 people attended the event to hear Clark's first official speech as mayor. As he spoke about council priorities for the next four-year term, he said those priorities include curbing racism.
Our service has to rise above ourselves to serve the citizens of our community. At a time where we see great opportunity and growth, yet we're impacted by challenges that face us on a daily basis. And some of those challenges, quite frankly, are despicable. And we have to face things like racism head on. We cannot allow hate to exist or persist in our world, and we have to call it out.
Later, Clark spoke with reporters to follow up on council's concerns about intolerance in the community. Clark says some people are reaching out to him personally for support.
I understand the volatility in the world right now and that people feel they can say anything without consequence. That's just not the case. And people taking something the way they might have thought it was funny, it was far from funny. And at the same time, for me to have people writing to me asking me to help them from racism because they feel attacked and threatened in the community as newcomers here, I will address those issues. I'm responding to individuals that are pleading for help, and especially individuals that have come here from away that just feel that they have no recourse or where to go. So this is going to be a very serious discussion with our police officials, but also it's an all citizens aspect.
Clark was asked if the focus on racism has anything to do with a weekend Halloween party at a local fire hall. A few people showed up wearing KKK costumes, resulting in a social media backlash condemning the act. Clark responds by saying racism in general is cause for concern in the community, not to mention he personally has been the victim of hateful comments because of his same-sex marriage.
It was going to be a point by virtue of I made commitments with people that reached out to me during the campaign about their fears around what was happening on the streets and people being harassed. And I've witnessed it myself of people being verbally assaulted and said, quite frankly, heinous things to them. And to have a senior citizen on the Esplanade come to me after I knocked on the door and start talking about how she just gets upset, how people in the building would talk about my being gay or queer and that, and talking about black people in a very derogatory way. This has to be addressed. It's an all-ages issue, and it's not acceptable in our community, and I think we need to send a very clear message that we are a welcoming community, we are a community that includes all, and we will not tolerate this. We're in a world right now that feels that words don't have consequence. Well, there will have consequences in the CBRM.
Clark says homophobic slurs shouldn't be tolerated either, and that he was targeted while campaigning during the recent municipal election.
I've come through, like I say, the previous election, and I'm used to putting up with crap from people throwing homophobic crap my way. I don't have to tolerate that, and I can speak it out. And as I said, the silent majority has got to gain a voice, and this community's got to say that we're here for everyone to be welcome, safe, and we're accessible, and we're going to be a pride of place community, not one of fear.
Clark says he wants the community on board with the efforts, and council will work with the police to figure out what the consequences should be for people who attack someone's sexual orientation or ethnicity. Meanwhile, Clark says council has other priorities for the upcoming four-year term, such as getting more people involved with local government. Voter turnout is down in the recent election, and Clark says that means council needs a better connection with the community and more positive interactions.
Look, whenever you have lower voter turnout, you could almost feel it in terms of going around, knocking on doors. You get a sense that there was almost a certain apathy, and there was a certain frustration. There's angst in our community. And so from the point of view of over 10,000 less people voting this time, statistically, you know, it's a question to ask, because the clerk's office, in fairness, all of the information went out a good in terms of letters with pins, where to vote, how to vote. It was a great ease to be able to vote. So the fact that people didn't, that's something I think that mayor, council, and the CBRN as a whole have to engage more. We have to be telling people how important these issues are. And maybe there's a level of what we have to do is just to get, when I say get back to basics, get back to informing people about the things that matter to them on a daily basis and prove value by being there and out in the community as I plan to be.
Voter turnout was 48.3% in the recent election compared to 2020's 51.3%. For the Local Journalism Initiative, Bill McCush.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
Out west to British Columbia, the Chocoteen National Government and the Museum of Vancouver are partnering up to repatriate ancestral belongings. Over 60 ancestral belongings have been returned to the Chocoteen territory in British Columbia so far. Sharon Fortney, the senior curator of Indigenous collections at the Museum of Vancouver, says that repatriation of artifacts is a key part of the museum's mission. Many of the items returned to the Chocoteen custody can now be viewed at the Chocoteen National Government Nassecox office in Williams Lake and the Chocoteen National Government. More on this story with Jesse Winsloff in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Over 60 ancestral belongings have been returned to Chilcotin territory in the central interior of British Columbia through a partnership between the Chilcotin National Government and the Museum of Vancouver. A delegation of elders, youth, children, women's council members, and former Chilcotin leaders traveled to Vancouver to collect the items and bring them home. Sharon Fortney, the senior curator of Indigenous collections at the Museum of Vancouver, says that this particular round of repatriation is the culmination of a long process.
Well, that grew out of a previous repatriation we did with one of six of the nations there. The other repatriation had been undertaken like 11 years previously, and it was actually ancestral remains to one specific community. At the time that work was done, they weren't ready to complete that repatriation. So we kept reaching out to them, and eventually they came to a place where they were ready to move forward. And while they were visiting us with elders and other knowledge holders from their community, we have like a big research table in our storage area, and the shelving directly behind it actually held several Chilcotin baskets. So community members were really like, they were looking at them, and they actually expressed to us that they didn't have any of those baskets back in their own community. Like maybe they'd been gifted four back by the government for some work they did, but generally they were absent from their communities.
Fortney explains that the repatriated items, including 29 coiled root baskets, 29 stone artifacts, a birch bark knife sheath embroidered with dyed porcupine quill, and one pair of snowshoes made from rawhide, sinew, and wood, are much more than simply objects or artifacts to the Chilcotin people.
There's a lot of knowledge wrapped up in sort of material belongings, and it's not, you know, we might look at it as just a functional object, but actually there's a lot of knowledge around how people use their land, where they went. When you're harvesting roots, you know, they might not be available everywhere. Some of the decorative materials, it might tell us something about climate change and resource management in those territories. It's also for the young people. It's a source of community pride. I think it's just really awakened a lot of questions in them about some of this missing knowledge that's in their community and how they're going to maybe go about bringing it back into practice, which I think is the, you know, part of healing and recovery. So it's really a beautiful thing.
The repatriation of artifacts is a key part of the Museum of Vancouver's mission and ongoing efforts towards reconciliation, representing a shift in philosophy for the Museum of Vancouver and other museums with collections of Indigenous artifacts.
The Museum of Vancouver is a nonprofit, and our role is to care for the City of Vancouver's collection. So the collection is close to 80,000 items, and about a third of them are Indigenous belongings, not just from our province, but from around the world. So we have collections from the South Pacific, Africa, South America, other parts of Canada and the U.S. So we have a collections policy that tells us our responsibility to the city for caring for their collection, and repatriation is part of that policy. We are still collecting, but we are the Museum of Vancouver. So in the past, the museum was started in the 1890s, and it was started by settlers who came from colonies all over the world. And that's why the collection is really diverse. And so you can't collect forever. You run out of space, you know. So it's really about what are the priorities of the Museum of Vancouver today. One of them is like redress and decolonization. So we are very open to repatriation requests from Indigenous communities, but we're also like reshaping the collection through our contemporary collecting. So most museums, they don't have very much money to do that work, but you know, we get a little bit each year, and we try now, if we're going to collect Indigenous made objects, we're looking at things that sort of are made by contemporary people, maybe artists, practicing artists that are made for sale or document some sort of an activity that they want to document. And so we're looking more towards host nation communities, Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh, and also Indigenous artists whose stories connect them to Vancouver. So we like have, for example, a few hundred pieces in our Plains collection. But what does that tell us about life in Vancouver? It doesn't tell us anything, right? So we are very open to repatriation requests from, especially from communities outside of the city.
The Chilcotin National Government and the Museum of Vancouver will continue the partnership that led to the repatriation of over 60 items, with the development of a new collaborative exhibit at the Museum of Vancouver to showcase the repatriation as an example of successful collaboration surrounding the repatriation of ancestral belongings.
They wanted to continue their relationship with us, and one of the plans they have for their belongings that they've repatriated is to share them amongst the different communities, and also they want to encourage other museums, I think, to do repatriation. They also want their community members to be aware of what repatriation is. So they wanted to do an exhibition with us. So it'll be under the title, The Work of Repair. So one component of that exhibition will be just about the celebration of the Chilcotin repatriation. And they filmed and photographed the baskets. They're still discussing with their representatives what they want to see actually in the exhibition, but there will be probably a film about their repatriation journey with the Museum of Vancouver. And then these beautiful photographs of the baskets touching the ground where they were, you know, made and came from. Like, that was a really important thing they wanted to do with them. And then they're applying for funds to eventually travel that to little museums and in surrounding communities where it can be shared widely in the Chilcotin area.
Many of the items returned to Chilcotin custody can now be viewed at the Chilcotin National Government DAZICO office in Williams Lake. And celebrating Chilcotin repatriation will be part of an exhibition entitled The Work of Repair, Redress and Repatriation at MOV, which is scheduled to open in the spring of 2025 at the Museum of Vancouver. Jesse Wensloff reporting.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints. Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
To Ontario now, where members of the Haliburton Highlands Outdoor Association recently met to collect the eggs of Haliburton gold trout, a fish found only in Haliburton County. They are working almost every year to ensure their survival by raising the fish at the hatchery. The Halliburton gold trout is what's known as a relic fish, meaning it was trapped in the area by glaciers during the last ice age. The annual egg collection is a partnership between the Ministry of Natural Resources and hatchery volunteers and gives the fish a far better chance for survival. They have a 90% survival rate when raised at the hatchery compared to only 1% if spawned in lakes. Here's part of Elizabeth Oakley's report. She's in Halliburton, Ontario.
On a clear Saturday morning at Halls Lake in Halliburton County, a small army of dedicated volunteers are carrying out a specialized mission. It's what members of the Halliburton Highlands Outdoor Association are doing to ensure a species of lake trout continues to thrive in the region's many lakes. Together at Elvin Johnson Park, the group is gathered to collect eggs from fertile females to improve the survival of the Halliburton gold trout, a fish found only here in the county. Dave Moss, who heads up the egg collection, explains how the process works and why it's so critical.
We will tend to get between 10 and 15 guys that'll come out for one of these. So we set up around 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and we're here till 2 or 3 in the morning in the dark and the cold. And the ministry guys just keep bringing us fish, and hopefully we get our maximum number of eggs we're allowed to take, and we pack up and go home.
While the process seems simple, there are a lot of moving parts, and everyone must work together to ensure the fish are well cared for throughout. Dave says the delicate job of collecting the eggs is well worth the effort.
You've seen them out in the boat, and they'll come back in. They have an aerated tank on their boat. They'll bring the fish to us here, and you'll see we have two tanks, one with an M on it, one with an F on it. And we will, terminology is sex the fish, and it's either a female, it's got eggs, or it doesn't. And they'll go into those tanks, and then we'll take the female fish into the trailer, we'll measure it, and then we'll extract the eggs and get her back in the lake as quickly as possible. And then we'll grab two males out of the male tank, and we'll use a squirt from each one into the eggs, and then it's a matter of mixing them up with a feather. From the beginning here, there are buckets of water that we bring from the hatchery. So these eggs will be in hatchery water right from their beginning. And then they'll go into another solution that they'll sit for about an hour, and that hardens the egg. And then we have a method of counting them, and we count each little bucket of eggs and record it. And when we get the number we want, this year it'll be 4,500 eggs, I believe, then we will take those eggs back to the hatchery, where we have specialized trays that they go in, and that's where they'll go. And every day they're checked. If there are dead eggs in there, which are white, good eggs are kind of an orangey color, then they'll be picked out and recorded how many, because not all the eggs survive. Around the end of November, I guess, you'll start to see a little black dot in that egg, and that's called eyeing up. The fish is developing inside the egg. Around the 15th of December, all of a sudden they'll start to wiggle around, and we have, they're called sac fry. And they will live off their egg sac for 2 or 3 weeks. And during that time, we will start to feed them so they will get used to artificial foods. And from there, they grow and they go into tanks and then bigger tanks. And 18 months from now, these guys will be stocked into Halliburton Lakes.
David Poirier knows a lot about fish. Prior to retiring, he worked for the Ministry of Environment in a lab where he checked the health of the fish. Now as a volunteer, he's the hatchery manager for HHOA, and the thrill of helping fish flourish never gets old.
The rewards of the group's hard work today will be felt years to come, from appreciative comments from anglers to donations to the club and more volunteers eager to help out.
I mean, this is a healthy fish here in this lake. Very, very healthy fish. So I don't think that they're becoming less and less, but it's just that we're giving people around the county an opportunity to sport fish for these. And that's good for tourism. We get all kinds of people that'll come to the hatchery and volunteer. The community, I think, really embraces how special this place is.
At day's end, volunteers celebrated meeting their goal, collecting between 4,500 and 5,000 eggs.
You're listening to Viewpoints.
And we stay in Ontario, where the Butterfly Away Project is encouraging people to help butterflies and bees by giving out seeds to grow native flowers, which are needed for butterflies, bees, and other insects. The Butterfly Away Project was started by the Suzuki Foundation many years ago and is active in Eastern Ontario through the Eco East environmental organization. Shauna Wanamaker, who leads the Butterfly Away Project, explains how landscaping and native flowers and grasses reduce mowing and monoculture lawns, and getting away from non-native cultivars can improve the survival of pollinating insects. Here's a very short excerpt of Candice Vetter's conversation with Mrs. Wanamaker in Carlsbad Springs, Ontario.
It does seem to be growing as a movement across North America. Our region started in 2022. I was introduced to Christina Enright, who is a monarch specialist, and she's also a butterfly ranger in North Stormont. She just inspired me to get involved. I learned so much. It completely turned my gardening world upside down, because I would often wander through my garden wondering, where are all the insects? And the one thing that caught me once when I was listening to her speak was the fact that she said, if something is eating my garden, I am super happy. And at that point, I didn't understand the loss of insects and our loss of habitat. And I was like, this lady's crazy. Who wants bugs eating their garden? Since then, I have learned that worldwide, we have lost 40%, I think it's now 41% of our insects. And without insects, our world is not going to function properly. And that loss of insects has come from the loss of our native plants, because there's so many cultivated versions out there that do not feed our insects the way they need. The roadside cutting is a huge issue. I'm witnessing it even now, wondering, why are we cutting down the tall grasses? It's not even tall, but the asters and the goldenrod that our migrating insects need, when those grasses could easily be a snow fence for humans as well. So I don't know what the drive is, but we have this incessant need to clean up everything everywhere. One of my roles as a ranger is to educate not just about native plants, but the impact that humans are having on our environment.
And to close the show, we stay on our green path as we move to the Notre-Dame-de-Grâce NDG West Island Borough in Montreal. That is where Japanese botanical ideas are making a breakthrough. A slope of the corner of Upper Lachine Road and Girouard Avenue will be getting an experimental microforest project. A microforest is when a wide range of trees and vegetation are planted in a concentrated area. Microforests are inspired by the Miyawaki method. The method generates a fast-growing forest in a small urban area. This is a first for the Notre-Dame-de-Grâce NDG area. Adam Innes in Montreal, Quebec.
The plan is still in the public consultation phase. The community council is asking community members what they hope the microforest could look like, what plants it could support, and fielding other ideas from the community. Here is the community organizer for the NDG Community Council, Aries Kalafoutis, speaking about what excites him about the project.
These trees, in combination with a variety of flowers and bushes, are part of the process that makes microforests very effective, which is a process by Japanese botanist, and growth of forests, of trees and plants, is accelerated almost to 100% when you combine all these different species together and you really clump them in a small area.
There is no clear timeline, but the section has been approved for planting as part of the NDG 2023-24 participatory budget.
That's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to all our journalists this week: Elizabeth Oakley, Jesse Winsloff, Adam Innes, Candice Vetter, Bill Nakush, and Johnny James. And to our national editors, Conrad Fox and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Many thanks for keeping us company this week, and hopefully until the next. Ciao.
Right, welcome back to another episode on Plugged in My Ears. Today we have Sam, Kyle, and Adam giving you guys your latest sports news. We've got some pretty big news in the world of hockey. Adam's got some personal news about Montreal Canadiens, so lots to get into here. We'll start with Adam, though. He's got a lot to say about the Montreal Canadiens.
Yeah, man, scared me with that personal news. Thought I was going to, like, introduce something, but...
Adam didn't know he actually had a disease.
Yeah, I'm actually introducing to you guys at a... Never mind. Okay, let's get started. Montreal. So the Montreal Canadiens played the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Probably won't win.
I went to the game for the first time. It was the first ever Montreal Canadiens game. It was so much fun. Childhood dream. Bucket list checked off. But I want to go back again now. It was an amazing experience. The sellout crowd for two teams that are the bottom of the league. It was crazy. When they scored, everyone was on their feet. There wasn't a person sitting down. Even the people in the wheelchairs were standing up, I swear. It was everyone was up on their feet. It was a fantastic game. Montreal kind of routed them, which is cool. It was actually close until the third period. They were only up 2-1 going into the third period. I got to see a fight, Arbor Jacki and Matthew Olivier. And Jacki did not win the fight. It was kind of a...
sad moment.
Ended up in a tie, I would say, but Jacki definitely would not have won on points. He wouldn't have Jake Pauled it, that's for sure. Huh. But you
Jake
know,
Pauled it.
It was a really good game, really good experience. Best atmosphere I've ever seen. I've only been to Sabres games, so this was definitely a step up from the Sabres. But even like I went to a Bills game last year, and I was like, you know what? I think the Montreal game tops it because I think maybe. Football just being more of an American thing and this being like hockey in Canada, I was like, this is like, I didn't feel patriotic, but I felt like this was more like my kind of style of sports.
I would say almost every Canadian team though is pretty darn passionate. Like basically equivalent to the Montreal Canadiens in some capacity. I'd say the Leafs are probably the only team that's not quite the same just because of how expensive the tickets are. But there are, the Leafs have the most diehard fans in the league, so there's no denying they have a huge fan base too.
Well, dude, I don't know if you can say that, no offense. I think the Montreal Canadiens do, like it's the Canadiens. The Montreal Canadiens, the people, and Adam, maybe you can agree with this, but the Montreal Canadiens is different than the Toronto Maple Leafs. The Toronto Maple Leafs is a big name that's known across the world, but there are Montreal Canadian fans that extend far beyond the reach of any Toronto Maple Leafs aspirations. But the thing about the Canadians, though, is their fan base is loyal because it's a different thing. Like, it's the Canadien. This is the Canadien that was abandoned by the French Empire when they lost the British conquest in North America. This is the Canadien that fought against the Iroquois of New France. This is the Canadien who fought the formidable defense of Quebec City with the General Moncan from France and their native-born governor, Pierre le Marquis de Vaudreuil. That's the Canadien de Montréal. It's not the Montreal Canadiens, as we say. It's different. Like, this is a nation. It's on those dreams and memories that they depend.
Okay, I don't know how old the Canadian team is that.
They spelled I-E-N-S, Canadien. It's like the team is, the idea is that they represent those people from New France who are native-born to what is today Quebec, who fought against English tyranny. That's why Montreal Canadiens were the center of so much French culture in Canada. That's why so many dissertations have been written on them, is because they are the spirit and the hope of a nation.
Yeah. No, I mean, after watching, I don't know if you guys have seen the Rocket movie about, like, Maurice Richard and how he was, like, fighting for French players, like, rights during the NHL because the early days, they were kind of not given the same calls as the English-speaking players or even the English-speaking teams. And he, like called out the commissioner, ended up getting suspended in, like, the Stanley Cup final. But, like, I can't think of a team that has had to, like, be that much of a symbol for a city. I also think that Toronto always having other sports teams like the Raptors and the Blue Jays kind of takes away from how much focus is centered on their hockey. And I think with Montreal being, they've got the Alouettes and the CFL, but it's more like Montreal is like, only the Canadiens, like they lost the Expos. Like they don't have baseball, they don't have basketball. I think that they're, it's like every bar you go into in Montreal, they're going to have a Canadiens something, I would say. I mean, maybe the majority, 99% of the bars would have some kind of Montreal Canadiens like flag or something. But in Toronto, I mean, I feel like you would get some that are like more Raptors specific or more Blue Jays specific. So I don't know. I think the focus is definitely more centered on hockey in Montreal. I mean, I've been in Toronto when, like, I've never been to a Leafs game in Toronto, but I've been in Toronto when a game's going on, and the street presence just wasn't the same. I mean, the energy outside of the building wasn't the same. I know it can be the same because, I mean, if you guys remember when the Raptors went to the finals and they had, like, Jurassic Park going on, that definitely, and they have, like, the Leafs, even in the playoff games, like, the first round especially. They've got, like, those Leafs guys out there. The fans are out there on, like,
the street off. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So it is that. But, I mean, for a regular season game, again, between two terrible teams, and there's still a crazy presence where they have to close the street off in front of this arena, I think that's unmatched.
But what was the coolest thing about watching the Canadiens play?
Coolest thing? Well, Shea Weber got inducted into the Hall of Fame and was also added to the Habs Ring of Honor. So
oh, wow.
He came and did a speech before the game. And they unveiled his, like, plaque that was at the back of the arena. And that was pretty cool to see because I didn't even know that was happening until, like, 10 minutes before the game started. And they said, oh, Shea Weber, welcome back, Shea Weber, honorary night. And then also getting to see, like, Sean Monahan and Jordan Harris, who are now on Columbus, getting to see their return to Montreal. That was pretty cool. But honestly, the fans, too. I think the fans are probably the best part. Like, the team is, like, it's not great. Like, it's not fantastic hockey. I mean, while even watching the game, I'm like, okay, like, there's a lot of mistakes being made here. And they are young. But the fans just are rallying behind these kids. And I think that that's beautiful. I mean, everyone had something good to say. But even when someone would, like, screw up a little bit, you would hear, like, a heckler being like, oh, Monty, what are you doing? Like, cover the five hole. Or Barron, like, because Barron, yeah. Justin Barron had a game, like, he had a bad game. He was back in the lineup for the first time in about a week or so, and he couldn't stay on his feet. I mean, he looked like me falling out there. He was diving on the puck. I was like, oh, man, someone's got to tell this guy to stand up. And then some Habs fan was yelling at him. Like, I was like, man's already all the way up here in the 400 level yelling down at Justin Barron. I thought it was hilarious. But yeah, hilarious. I would say the fans were the best part. That's the coolest part, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool. Yeah. But maybe we'll talk about other stuff in hockey. I mean, Kai, you've looked into this more than I have, but Darnell Nurse got taxed a little bit.
Yeah, well, speaking of Toronto, I mean, you got one of the dirtiest players in the league, not known for much else than bruising up other players. I'll start with a funny joke I heard someone say about the Reeves hit. So, well, Reeves had a high hit on Darnell Nurse when he was going around the net. It was kind of almost a borderline blindsided, shoulder to head contact. Just, I don't know. We don't really know the extent of the injury, so it hasn't really been published yet. But Nurse left the game after that hit. He was darn shaken up. There's a lot of blood. Visor cut his face. Not looking so good. But I think Reeves has gotten a 5-game suspension, and some people were saying a worse punishment for the Leafs would be to play him for 20 minutes a game for the next 10 games. It'd be like almost worse than having him suspended, because they'd just lose like the next 4 games if he was playing, you know, most of the game. But he's not definitely not known for his hockey skill, and he goes out and around once in a while and just makes a fool of himself. So yeah, not great. I don't even think that many Leafs fans are that happy with that one, because there's not really much to argue there.
No. Well, what happened to Nurse really though? What cut his face open? Was it his visor or the elbow or the shoulder to the face?
That, you know what? I didn't really get it like a super close look at it. The visor cut his nose. Like it kind of brushed up and cut his nose. Some people are saying there was some blood near his eyes though, so I don't know.
I feel like that's from the visor to the eyes.
I think the visor just fucking, it just crushed his face, yeah. But
hey, sometimes you gotta be careful. Those visors are razor sharp, like.
Yeah. Well, I just remember playing like in a hockey game once. It was kind of a fluke almost, but I just remember like one of my teammates went down to block a shot and he tilted his head a bit and a slap shot went right in the ear and shattered the plastic part there, and it cut a piece of his ear off.
Oh, so it cut the piece of his ear entirely off.
Yeah. So there was just like tons of blood on the ice, and he was like, he borderline fainted because there was so much blood. So yeah, they got a stretcher and pulled him off and stuff. So there's just weird stuff like that happens. It looked so terrible. It's like, oh my God, he's got hit in the head. Like there's so much blood. Like, you know, did what happened to his like skull or something? Mm-hmm. But it was just, a piece of his ear ripped off. But it looked pretty darn bad from the sideline. Yeah, but he was totally fine in the end.
You know, it's funny. I played a lot of hockey, but I've never really seen any injuries like that. One of my good buddies cut his Achilles tendon playing. Mm. A guy on the other team went to hit him. And you know, sometimes when players go to hit other players, they'll turn around and hit them with their butt or their hip, sort of. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, he tried to counter that hit with his butt and hip as well. And then when they collided, the other player's back foot sliced his Achilles tendon. I think it was complete 100% tear or slice, but I don't quite remember. But that didn't even bleed that much either.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know what?
I think your ears bleed a lot, though. Isn't that a thing?
Yeah, they bleed a fair amount. I mean, the scare is that usually when you're bleeding a lot from the head region, that's not good thing. News. So,
no.
So, yeah, that's definitely not great. But, yeah, no, there's definitely fluke injuries in hockey. And once you're not wearing a cage, it changes a lot, right? So you can get bloody face pretty easily. Point being, though, that was super dirty hit on Nurse, and he was really shaken up from that. So 5-game suspension is much.
Well, do you guys think that's enough or not enough of a suspension? Like, what are your thoughts on it?
You know what? I think there should have been, like, some monetary penalties imposed, because it's kind of hard to do, like, the more suspensions and stuff. Like, just fine the team X amount. That's pretty common to get a fine like that. So,
but, I mean, this guy's been on a minimum contract his whole career. I mean, I don't know if he can afford that. Like, they got him.
I mean, yeah, but
has he been his whole career? No, I thought I think he might have got paid a little bit more than that at one point.
He you got to punish those kind of things like that. Yeah. That kind of hit which frankly there wasn't even a major play going on. Like he was just clearing the puck. Like he was literally just cycling the puck with a out of the zone in a breakout, and he just got demolished for the blindside hit. Like nothing, you didn't move any play there. He didn't even get the puck from Nurse. He just tried to hurt him.
Yeah.
Like. That kind of play is not, I don't have no sympathy for that, right? Like, if he was making a play for the puck and he actually got it or, like, attempted to get the puck, I'd be like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, he literally just tried to flag him.
Yeah.
But you think you think that's justified 5 games?
Oh, God.
Yeah, Adam, yeah. Like, you don't think it should be more or less?
I think it should be 5 games. I think that's a reasonable penalty for it. I do like the idea of having him play 25 minutes a game. 20 minutes a game, that'd be hilarious.
Yeah, that would be.
Yeah, you have to replace Austin Matthews on the first line.
Yeah, that's the consequence.
Yeah, no, that'd be hilarious. But no, I think that it's a shame to see, because I feel like there haven't been too many suspensions recently in the NHL. I mean, I
actually can't really think of it.
I remember it being such a.
It was a common occurrence when we were younger.
Yeah, I would swear it was like every week someone was in like having like a meeting with players.
I remember OV was suspended all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. He had to miss an All-Stars game because he got suspended twice before it.
I remember that, yeah. No, I don't know. It's just sad to see too because I thought we were kind of past some of those dirty plays. And I think the league's overall has gotten cleaner over the last few years. And the quality of the hockey's gotten better. I mean, but as long as you've got goons like Reeves around, you're going to have issues like that with people playing dirty. And I mean, it's like, I mean, even Arbor Jack on Montreal, like he's a bit of a goon. I mean, he's out there for a reason, right? So it's not like a single team that's doing it or a single player that's doing it. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
Well, the thing I was talking to Sam about this a while ago, but I was saying one of the main differences I'd say that changed in hockey is that the players are so fast now and so skillful that the only way you're going to hit them is you're going to end up hitting them dirty. Like, it's basically impossible to get a clean hit on someone nowadays because they're just so fast and they're low to the ice, right? Like, when you skate, you lower yourself down. So you're probably going to get head contact.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, like, if you're trying to hit, like, someone like McDavid, chances are you're going to either trip him, get a head contact, or just miss him outright and then just get completely burned. So pinching someone like that is just a bad move. I think that's part of the reason why there's less suspensions because you just can't hit people anymore because you usually just get torched.
Yeah.
You go for the pinch and the guy just burns around you and then you just look like a fool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think 5 games is justified a bit, but I thought it was going to be, I just thought it was going to be more.
Yeah, more than 5 is pretty rare. That's like...
Yeah, I can't even really think of a 10-game suspension. I said that it might be 10 games before, but I guess that was kind of unrealistic.
I think...
It might have been 10 if you, like, singularly tried to injure him and there was no puck around at all.
Yeah, he definitely got a pretty major warning, and I'm sure if he did it again this season, then they might not be very favorable towards him, but...
Yeah, but on a separate note, maybe we can talk about the battle of the IQs that occurred on a Friday night between Jake Paul and Mike Tyson. Jake Paul came out in the little... car that was supposed to mock Mike Tyson's TV show with this pigeon. I guess Logan White was supposed to be the guy on Mike's TV show that's not colored in all the way because they didn't have enough money, so he just wore all the same color. And then Mike Tyson walked out looking like Joe Biden as though he had dementia.
Yeah.
That was a rough bout. What'd you guys think?
You know what? I think it was just a really... It's all marketing. It's just a, you know...
They made Mike look pretty good before that fight series.
I don't think Mike Tyson would have signed up for, like, first of all, people forget he rejected this fight multiple times originally. Like, Jake Paul's been trying to get him to do this for years, and he rejected it a lot. And he only accepted it recently because Jake Paul just offered him like $20 million cash up front, which he was just like, well, okay, that's like $20 million for essentially doing nothing.
Yeah.
So. Sure, I guess. But the main reason why he wouldn't agree to it is no 60-year-old man is going to agree to a fight that you have potential of getting knocked out. When you like get to that age, like getting knocked out, your chances of getting severe brain damage or a severe concussion are severely elevated. Like, it is not worth that kind of risk. Like, you could actually get... He's already gotten enough head trauma, right? So he could literally like walk out of there if he got knocked out with some serious like long-term problems with his head, right? So... He would never have agreed to like an actual fight. And it turned out, yeah, they just did some kind of sparring, showing, get the crowd, not what they wanted, but just basically it was kind of like one of those, you know, it sounds familiar to this, just about everything in Logan and Jake Paul's life where it's all the build up the hype just to rug pull it out from under people at the end, right? You'll amp up the product so much that to the point that people will buy into it, but all you do in the end is just provide the product at the minimal. It's a total scam, obviously, right? But you provided something in the end, not what you promised, though.
Yeah. No, I think the real fight was the one that was like two fights before. The Mario Barrios and Abel Ramos fight.
Oh, that was a good fight.
You guys watched that?
Yeah, that was a good fight.
Ended in a tie or like a draw. I haven't really seen too many of those, especially like when it goes to the scorers and all three scorers come back with a tie. Yeah. Like that's, I think one of them came back with a tie and then the other two came back with like the same margin of victory, but for opposite fighters. So it was a tie. That was a good fight. A lot of mutual respect there too. That was like, it was pretty cool to see. But even the women's fight,
I actually like that one the best.
Also really good too.
I thought
Katie Taylor. I don't think she should have won that fight. I kind of thought the fight went to Serrano rather than Katie Taylor.
Well, that's a biased opinion. We only watched like the last two rounds or something.
So the women's fight, we watched the whole thing.
No, we didn't. They cut out Oh, he missed a bunch of rounds. I think, well, you know, people were saying there that what was her name, Taylor, or was using her head a lot. And I honestly, I think I agree with them. But the funny thing is, I don't think it's her fault. I think her head is just like really strong, and she has these very pronounced eyebrows, like that are almost like sharp. Like her skull is kind of sharp there, and it seems like that almost is like able to cut her opponents when they bang heads, because they both like hit each other in the head at the same time. Like, no, it wasn't a headbutt or anything, but her head's just stronger and I guess sharper somehow, and it just shredded the other woman's head. So. And it apparently
was really ugly to look.
Apparently, it happens all the time with her fights. Like, the other opponent gets injuries to the head all the time.
Wow.
Because I think her head's just so strong. But I guess, you know, you can't really do anything against that. Like, she just got a stronger head than you or something. But yeah. But no, she was also like, I think she was the more technical fighter. She's an Olympic boxer, which I said Olympic boxing is extremely different than regular boxing. It's all about technicalities, getting the points, and kind of like, it's almost like a checklist of getting like the right score, like kind of maxing out the scorecard, which regular boxing is a bit of that, but it's also more about just like, let's say, putting on a better show and like hurting the other person a bit more, whereas you can hurt the other person more in Olympics and not necessarily win because you didn't get all the points.
Yeah.
But I think that carried over for her a little bit. She was able to kind of cash in on the scorecard by just getting those points in. But yeah, that was a bloody fight, and there wasn't much... what we were saying was there was actually wasn't very much blocking. It was like these was flurries of like crazy offense where both of them just like pounded each other at the same time. And then they would kind of back off a little bit, arms down.
Yeah.
And just kind of waiting. And then just another flurry of just like just destroying each other with little to no defense.
Yeah. No, but overall, I think it was a pretty decent night. It was entertaining to watch. But I think the Tyson-Paul fight was the least entertaining out of all of them.
Terrible.
Apparently, the announcers were saying that people started leaving the fight after the fourth round.
Yeah.
They started flooding out of the building, yeah. But what was cool about the fight, I thought, too, is just the amount of interesting people that were watching. Like, Shaq was there. Gronk was there. Well, Gronk and Shaq were together. Mm-hmm. But there's more celebrities than that. I'm pretty sure Hulk Hogan was there, too.
I think the best part was seeing Mike Tyson's buttocks.
Oh my god, was that ever funny?
It's a pretty big TV blooper there, yeah.
I couldn't believe they just aired that. That was crazy.
Yeah, they did Mike dirty.
No. Or did you see that one interview he did with that kid where she asked him, like, I think it was a kid interviewer. Mm. And she's like, "Oh, what's your like legacy that you want to leave?" And Mike was just like, "Oh, I don't care about legacy. We're all going to die in the end anyways. So like what's the point of like having a legacy?" He's like, "Why would you ask me that?" Yeah, he went crazy on this little girl, and she was just like, she handled it really well. She was like, "Oh, well, I've never heard that answer before." And I don't know what was going through Mike's head. If he was just that locked in that he was like not aware that he was even talking to a child.
I think he was just, he's like a really competitive person by nature. Mm-hmm. And I think that he signed on to this fight that was fully not a fight. Like, it was essentially just like a showing to kind of like, basically take money from people.
Yeah.
And he probably felt kind of bummed out about it because he didn't actually get to compete. Like, he just went in there, it was a cash grab, and left. Like,
yeah.
But I'm sure that tortured him. And you could kind of see it in his face when he walked out for the fight. Like, he did not look that happy. He kind of just looked dead, tired, and just not happy to be there.
I still can't get over the fact that in the prelude to the fight, they made Mike Tyson look like he was so fit. Every video I've seen of Mike Tyson, it looked like he was going to kill Jake Paul.
I think the thing was, like, I watched that fight, and, like, he definitely, like, he's pretty old. Like, obviously, he's going to get tired, but he straight up did not try, like, at all. Like,
he just looked wobbly.
Yeah, but he wasn't even throwing punches.
No. Like, I think it's because he was wobbly.
I know, but he went out there for, like, at least the last five rounds. I swear he did not throw a punch.
Like, yeah, no, he only had 18 landed hits.
I can't lie. There's no way you're telling me that, like, that was him trying full effort. Like, I don't believe that. I actually don't.
No, I don't really.
Also, yeah, and not to mention, like, come on. Like, the way Jake Paul is fighting this guy, like, he literally, I don't know boxing that well, but I'm pretty sure measuring someone up is when you, like, you pose out your arm so you can see how far you have to be away from them to hit them, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Jake Paul was literally measuring him up, like, holding out his arm, and he knows he's got 6 inches reach on him,
mm-hmm.
holding his arm out, measuring him up, and then staying about at that distance so he could literally just do like little cheap tap jabs.
Yeah.
And just like, he would throw like, you know, 100 punches in each round, and he would get like two, and they like barely scratched him. Like, it was like two light tap jabs. And I was just like, what am I watching?
It was not a great fight, but whatever. It is what it is, I guess. Although I'm excited because it sounds like Gronk and Shaq are going to fight.
They
announced it during the fight. A lady interviewed them and said, what'd you consider doing? And Gronk looked at him. They hugged each other. And then Shaq said, I'm going to eat him for breakfast. So they said they're going to announce the fight in the coming 2 months.
I want to see Shaq and like Barkley or something. That would be
Shaq and Barkley would be hilarious.
Yeah, that'd be good, yeah.
I'd actually like to see Evander Kane go against Jake Paul.
Evander Kane was trying to do that, right?
Yeah, he was, and Jake Paul shut him down. Also, who is Jake Paul to call out Canelo, acting as though Canelo needs him?
Yeah.
He said, Canelo needs me. Canelo doesn't really care about you. I think Jake kind of fumbled the bag on this one for marketing. He just pissed off the whole world by beating the greatest heavyweight of all time. Yeah. And he didn't really do it in a very charismatic way.
No, it was not classy at all. No. I mean, the whole thing.
It didn't even look legitimate. Like,
the whole thing looks like a staged fight.
I don't know if this news headline was true, but apparently, is it true that they got banned from the Boxing Federation after this?
Oh, maybe. I didn't read that, but that's possible.
I think
possible.
I saw something on that. I don't know if that's, maybe that's...
Tyson and Paul?
Yeah, I don't know if that's legit or what that means.
Who knows? Mike Tyson also called out Logan Paul, though, so maybe that's why they did that, if they did do it. Make sure that fight doesn't happen.
Anyway, I think the point is Mike Tyson cashed out and... He's kind of laughing, like, he didn't do anything and got paid $20 million essentially, right? So, and I don't think anyone was actually like that disappointed with him, to be honest.
No,
it's honestly impressive that he was able to do anything. But
it is impressive that he was able to get much done. But on a separate note, it's kind of early to talk about this, but the World Juniors are coming to Kingston. True story.
Mm-hmm.
The United States will play Czechia here on December 24th, no 23rd, in an exhibition game. But then after that, it's all in Ottawa, pretty much.
I actually don't know has our roster been declared for World Juniors yet? I don't think
it's yet. No, they usually wait a little bit for that. But Team USA is going to be the USNDTP U20 with a bunch of college guys.
Yeah, Canada, like, we usually declare late. Like, we don't need.
We're probably the last team to put a roster together.
Oh my god, yeah.
Well, I think they are also one of the rare. No, I don't know if it's rare, but they seem to have like. Like, I think that all the other international teams kind of, like, practice throughout the year together.
Oh, yeah, they do. They train the whole year. They train the whole year together.
Yeah, and then Canada doesn't do that.
And they have 3 practices before the tournament.
That's what I mean. They have training camps before the tournament, for the tournament, and then they make cuts, essentially, is how they do their team's roster selection. But, like, yeah, like you said, they're always, like, the latest, I think, to register their team or...
Yeah. Well, I remember the COVID year in which Shane Wright declined to be the captain and the play on the team after he didn't get drafted where he thought he'd get drafted. Because remember, they had to push it back.
Mm-hmm.
They made their team 2 days before that tournament started.
That's crazy.
2 days. They chose the roster.
Yeah.
Anyways, it worked out. We won gold.
Yeah.
So, it wasn't a problem. But
I actually... Who were the main prospects that we've got playing on there? I actually don't really know right now.
Kai Iginla.
Yeah, Iginla.
He's going to be there for sure. Honestly, everyone who was drafted who was Canadian the first 3 rounds of the NHL is probably going to be on that roster. Who isn't proactively playing?
Brent Clark, probably.
No, I don't think LA's going to give him up.
I don't think he's going to be allowed to play, though. He's been playing too well.
He's also 21.
Oh, you're right, because he was held back. Yeah, okay, never mind.
Yeah, he's too old. But Celebrini, maybe, if San Jose wants to give him up. I don't think San Jose's going to give Celebrini up. He's doing too good.
But maybe he got injured, too. They're probably not. They're probably hesitant. Yeah.
Like Zane Perec I feel there's a bunch of guys that are going to be able to make it out of the junior team, junior leagues. But
yeah, it's kind of hard to say who has a chance on playing because there's obviously very good guys who are much better than most people in the O, the Q, and the W. But a lot of the good guys kind of blend in. Like, it's really just coaching preference at that point.
Yeah.
Like, it tends to be that if your coach is from the W, more players are from the W. If he's from the Q, more players are from the Q. And if they're from the O, more players are from the O. Although Canada's never had a coach in the World Juniors that I know of who coached in the NCAA. They've always been OHL, QMJHL, and WHL coaches.
Do you know if there's ever been a player on Canada's junior team from the USHL?
From the USHL?
Yeah.
Devin Levi.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. I guess he was in the USHL. I forgot about him.
Well, actually, here's the thing with Devin Levi. He played his year in the CCHL, and then he signed in the USHL for the next year. And in that summer period is when the games occurred. Like, that's when he played for the WHL for the first time.
Okay,
Technically, he played once in the CCHL as the third string goalie, and then 1 year as in the USHL as the actual goalie.
Okay, all right. Cool. I was just thinking because Montreal...
Owen Power.
Is
Chicago.
Or was he at college at that time?
Because he played with a cage at 17, right? Yeah, he did.
Yeah, anyway.
So he played one year with Chicago Steel, and then the rest of it was when he was at college at Michigan. Okay.
All right. Yeah. Because
so, yeah, I guess USHL players who are Canadian have played.
Yeah. No, because Montreal's got that Michael Hage guy, and he was in the USHL last year, and I was just...
Where is he now?
I think...
Is he in the NCAA?
Wisconsin.
The Badgers... Yeah. The Badgers don't really have anyone who didn't play in the USHL. But on the topic, NCAA hockey's pretty nuts, too. Like, just the people they pick up
is crazy. It's getting better. Definitely getting better. Yeah. I don't know. I think...
Oh, Michigan.
Michigan.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah, that's usually a pretty good feeder team.
Yeah. So, yeah, there'll be players from everywhere, which is kind of cool. I think it's, like, definitely used to be more of just the junior leagues, like OHL, WHL, Q, and then now it's USHL, NCAA, everything kind of. So,
yeah, it's an amalgamation of all the leagues.
Yeah, because I guess, wasn't Celebrini USHL to NCAA route?
But that's, he's Canadian. Yeah. I actually don't know why these Canadians are choosing the NCAA route, but that's going to change anyways. The NCAA now said you can play in the CHL and then come play here.
I don't think it's going to make hockey in Canada better. I think like
it's going to make it worse, actually.
Yeah, I think it's going to make it worse. Yeah.
So, anyways. Yeah. But on that note.
That's a topic for next week.
Yeah. On that note, thank you so much for listening to Plugged In My Ears. This is Kyle, Adam, and Sam. We hope you join us again next week.
Do you love playing board games? Are you looking for a place on campus to make friends in a relaxed environment? Look no further than Queen's Board Game Club. Join us for weekly Thursday game nights on campus.